Welcome to We Are Libertarians. My name is Chris Spangle, and our goal is to help you sound smarter while talking to your friends. So what we do here is examine current events from a libertarian perspective, and we treat it with a little irreverence as well. And this is from our series called The Swamp Explained, and I think this is the fifth one that we've done. Approximately a year ago, it was about a year and 2 weeks ago, I went out to Students for Liberty in Washington, D.C. and got stranded in Philadelphia, and I met Rob Cortell, and we ended up the next morning driving down to Washington, D.C. from Philly, and he started telling me all these stories, and I couldn't believe, I had to Google just to verify that he was who he was saying, because it was incredible. I couldn't believe that I ended up in the car with him. And it turns out Rob is a 45-year fly on the wall in Washington, D.C., and he's worked for Republican presidential campaigns, which we're going to talk a little bit about today, government agencies like the EPA. He's been confirmed by the Senate to the U.S. Federal Maritime Commission, and he's been a candidate for Congress as a Senate in the congressional race and a Senate race. And given his experience and iconoclastic view, he gives us an insight into the swamp, because what we love to do here at We Are Libertarians is try to understand the world as opposed to tell the world how it ought to be. And so when I met Rob, I said, you know, it'd be great if we could do a series on the show explaining the swamp and just kind of giving an insight as to how politics actually works. And so, Rob, we've enjoyed this a lot, and I'll say at the outset, we have plans to do this more frequently, and we'll probably spin it off into its own RSS feed and little podcast brand here soon. You've had some life changes, so I enjoy this, and I have heard from a lot of our listeners that they're like, you know, it's really interesting to hear from someone who lives in the swamp. You're not necessarily a swamp monster. You're probably more of an irritant there, aren't you?
Well, you know, there was certainly a time in my life when I thought I wanted to become a swamp monster, you know, but now I go back and forth between the swamp and my home on the Chesapeake Bay.
Yeah. So,
and it's actually kind of interesting, because down here on the Bay, you get a lot of Trump voters who are very much not the kind of voter that I see up in Northern Virginia, where my company is located, or in Washington, D.C., where, you know, where I've lived all this time. So it's a lot of fun.
I think anybody who's interested in politics, you watch The West Wing, and then you're like, I want to be a swamp monster. That sounds like fun. But then
yeah.
I think to do it, there has to be some level of... I knew that I could get there, but I'm not good at kissing butt. I have a problem. I just have a problem of saying things that I shouldn't. I have a problem. I just am too honest at some points and in the wrong crowds, I guess.
Well, you know, though, but remember, when I came to Washington in 1973, I had graduated with a degree in environmental science out of Rice and all that. And I had spent some time already as a student working with the Environmental Protection Agency. And it was a period when government was doing a lot of very interesting things under, believe it or not, Richard Nixon. And so, you know, I got to Washington, and it was a very exciting time. Not long after I got there, we had the oil embargo, and, you know, the country was slammed by that, and new agencies, and I think there were just an awful, Vietnam was ending, and there were just an awful lot of people my age, which at that time was 23, who were inspired by the opportunity to do something for their fellow citizens. So, you know, no one was thinking about being a bureaucrat. You know, you were thinking about, and I actually see some of that. I've seen some of that in the last 4, 5, 6 years as well, although it's sort of dying down. And we now have the problem with Google and some of these other companies that I actually admire a lot of what they do. Employees actually don't want to be part of the government. So some very interesting tensions.
Yeah. And, you know, I mentioned that you worked for some presidential campaigns, and this is the part where I really went like, wow, is this real? Like, you were actually the issues director for Gerald Ford's campaign and H.W. Bush's campaigns. In what years? When were you?
Well, Ford was 1976. And then, so in the Ford campaign, you know, if you're working for a president, a sitting president, the campaign doesn't actually have much say in, they're not the ones writing policy. You know, you have an administration, the White House had already a record. You sort of have to explain and repackage. And so in that one, I was 26 years old, at 25 going on 26. We had what's called the answer desk. Someone would call and say, what is the Ford position on this or that? And, you know, I'd have to dig out from the White House and other sources what the administration had done, and had a big group of volunteers of some State Department, CIA, and others, the retirees, and we would craft an answer. You know, it was the beginning of political questionnaires, and, you know, in the early days, we sort of answered everything, and over time, campaigns have decided not to answer anything, as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
There's a danger in having a position. So, but I will say, with the perspective of now, that's 76. So that's, was that 40 some years, right? 43 years. A lot of things never change. But so in that one, the job really was to sort of figure out what the position was and package it in a way that was politically palatable. But in 1979, the Bush campaign was different. That one, I really, you know, the job really was to pull a bunch of advisors together, figure out what the options were that were consistent with kind of the philosophy the candidate had, and then turn that into a position paper. And, you know, I had gone through grad school and gone back to Houston to start a company that was doing, we were using salt domes for the commercial sector. So this is kind of a divergence here from the presidential saga, but you know, oil is, you find these big magnetic domes of salt that kind of bubble up over oil. It's sort of it indicates where oil can be found, and then the oil is pulled out, and the government decided during embargo in the 70s, early 70s, to flip the process and fill some of these with oil for emergencies, to refill it, put it back in the ground. And that was the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And I had gone out there with a guy who had formerly headed that to see if we could turn that into a commercial venture. And we were out in Houston, and one day I get a call from George H.W. Bush, who I didn't know at that time. I had worked for his Senate race as a student volunteer at Rice, but heard about my work with the Ford campaign from several advisors to Ford who are now advisors to him. And I went over, had lunch with him at his office, and I liked what he was doing. He was a very strong Republican with huge amounts of experience. You know, he'd been ambassador to China. He'd been chairman of the Republican Party. He was a several-term congressman, a business guy. He started one of the most impactful oil companies in the country at that time. His company was the first one, Zapata Oil, was the first one to go offshore and dig in the water, you know, send wells down in the water. So, you know, he was it was very exciting to meet him.
Was he the head of the CIA at that point?
No, he had already been head of the CIA.
Okay.
And which he always said was his favorite job. He just loved the CIA.
You're talking to a libertarian. That's creepy.
I know. Well, but the other side of it, think about, you know, a lot of the CIA, early CIA, was certainly people just like George H.W. Bush. Now, they were blue bloods out of the Northeast. They were well-educated, Yale's, Harvard guys, you know, Penn State, all these kind of people who they were very patriotic people. And, of course, a lot of them did it at very great risk. Julia Childs, right? Wasn't CIA, but she was an operative for the British government, I think, at that time. I can't remember which.
It was the American version. I think it was the OSS. I think that's
OSS.
What
it was the OSS.
She created shark repellent, That was her claim to fame. Yeah.
Yeah. That's so, right. And her husband was too, you know, the whole gang.
So you were fairly high up in the Ford campaign, right? So how did you get into that? And how did you get at such a young age, that level of responsibility?
That was pretty accidental. I had been, in the Ford White House, as a senior junior staffer with the Presidential Clemency Board. You know, we've talked before about Ford after he pardoned Nixon had to, there was such an outroar that he, anger from certain quarters that he also wanted to figure out what he could do to, quote, heal the nation. And so he decided to pardon the Vietnam era war resistors. The war had just ended the year before for American involvement, and set up the Presidential Clemency Board to kind of go through all the records and see the kinds of things that had given them bad discharges and all that. And if you recall from earlier shows, we ran some 35,000 young people through that in the course of one day short of a year. That was also very inspirational in its own way. I think, you know, one of the guys I've talked about before was an African-American who'd gone to three tours in the war and come back on the third tour through Germany and gotten busted on a drug charge and cashiered and lost his medical benefits. He'd been wounded several times, which was fundamentally unfair. And that's kind of where Ford was coming from. So actually I heard an interesting, read something interesting the other day, or heard it, I can't remember, about Ford is probably the only guy, and we can talk about this later in the State of the Union, who ever gave a State of the Union that did not begin with the State of the Union is good. he said the State of the Union is not good, and went on to tick off 10% inflation and unemployment and all of these things. And of course he lost, he barely lost, but he did lose, despite having, I think, turned around a fair amount of that. But anyway, so I was after the Clemency Board, three of us got a grant from Notre Dame University to write a book about that group of people that had gone through, about Vietnam veterans and the whole Vietnam era. Father Ted Hesburgh was the head of Notre Dame, and he had been a board member. And so I was the low man on a totem pole of three people writing this book, but we had collected the data from all of their experiences. And the net of that was that, you know, there were probably 100 million young people who were technically eligible by age during the course of the war to go to war, but 51% were immediately rejected because they were women, which would not happen today. And then a big chunk were rejected because they were college or in college or graduate school. And eventually, something like only about 3 million, that's a big number, but only about 3% of the people who were technically eligible by age actually made it to Vietnam. So it was, and the title of the book was Chance and Circumstance. And it's not in publication anymore, but you can find it on Amazon. And it talked about a lot of those very things that you, whether you ended up being drafted or sent to the war or not, was totally a chance or circumstance. So anyway, so at some point I decided to start volunteering for the campaign, which was not far from my office. And one day I got made an offer and I took it. And that offer was to run that operation. You know, I'd gone over to help them write policy positions and all those things. So it was sort of was a natural.
So what was Gerald Ford like as a person? I mean, I imagine you spent a lot of time around him.
Didn't spend a lot of time with him per se, because he was, the campaign's a totally different entity, and the Clemency Board was in a different office too. After a while, we started out right at the White House, but you know, he was a very affable, natural kind of person. And you know, until the Bushes were there, it was said that the guy that the Secret Service, who was around him all day long and all night long, liked him better than anybody they'd been around. And you know, and they have all liked the Bushes, who were very affable and easygoing too, particularly but he was athletic. I just remember his stumbling down the airplane steps. And despite the fact that he probably was the most athletic president we've had in quite a long time, he was portrayed as this physical kind of buffoon. You know,
Chevy Chase and Saturday Night Live had just begun, and yeah, Chevy Chase.
That's played, right.
Yeah, he falling into the Christmas tree.
Yeah, that's right.
But he was a university.
There were some great shows, but you know what? It didn't bother him. He was the kind of person who kind of understood the game, and he had a long record in the Congress. So it was for him. He knew what the game was.
So you then get this call from George H.W. Bush in 78, 79, and then you meet with him. And what's that first meeting like?
You know, it was just two people sitting down. You know, he had heard about me from a guy named Dave Gergen, who is still a commentator and who was in the Ford White House in the campaign, and then who was close to him. And then he and another guy, a mentor of mine, Paul McAvoy, who later was on the Council of Economic Advisors under Ford and who I got to know well at Yale later. And he had formed a political action committee to support candidates for Congress. And so we talked about, you know, his race for Senate and what he was thinking about doing. And we agreed that I'd start helping out with the campaign. I started as a volunteer, really, and in the Houston office. And that started out fairly low-key. I was actually I was the third person who came on the staff under, you know, who was hired. There's a group of us who were called the three percenters. We were with Bush before he was an asterisk in the polls. And you know, an asterisk is under 3%. But he was just a very easygoing guy. You know, and he also was naturally athletic and just a nice person, you know.
Who are the other two people who was hired before you were?
Probably Margaret Tutwiler was there before that. And let's see, David Keene came later. I was one of the group that interviewed him. I think David Bates was there. He was kind of the keeper of the body and everything associated with Bush. A guy named Dave Sparks came in just about that time. Then Jim Baker was already chairman. Karl Rove was very involved in the congressional PAC, but he really was not involved in the campaign, the presidential campaign. And, you know, there was a little bit of bad blood between some of the staff people at that point. Not with the president, not with Bush or Carl, but I think Carl just decided he didn't want to do the presidential campaign.
So Bush had run for Congress and Karl Rove worked on that campaign.
I don't know if he worked on the congressional campaigns. You know, Carl was probably just out of the RNC. He, if I recall, he was running the Young Republican operation, but he was very involved with Bush, with the congressional PAC, you know, the Political Action Committee that Bush set up to fund 1978 campaigns.
Got it. So he started a PAC to basically, it's sort of like what Nixon did in 66. What Nixon did.
Well, they all do it. All these candidates.
Right. So he went around the country in 66 helping congressional campaigns.
That's right.
And so they owed him a favor in 68. And that's how he kind of, I just read James Buchanan's books on Nixon, which were fascinating reads. I really didn't know Nixon was that Buchanan was that close to Nixon. So it sounds like you were his Buchanan. You were H.W.'s Buchanan.
Probably not. Not quite.
But no. So was W around at any? Were you around him at all through?
Well, so campaign? The way that evolved was that. I you know, helped out as a volunteer in the congressional PAC. And then, of course, once the elections were over, then they started going really lickety split down the road, and if I recall, I think Bush put in $100,000 of his own money, which was a lot of money in those days, and considered a significant commitment. And then campaign started in earnest and set up a headquarters in D.C., in Alexandria. I still remember the building. And I would fly every month or so between Houston and Kennebunkport in Washington. My job at that point, by then, was to put together advisors. And to so, for example, he had a group of people on the economy, which included Bill Niskanen, who was the chief economist for, I think, Ford, if I recall. Had a very senior guy from 3M, a really nice guy. He had George Shultz on foreign policy. I mean, he consulted Kissinger. You know, he basically knew everybody from the establishment. If they were someone, he knew them. And so the job was really to put together a series of events up at Kennebunkport, where they would spend the night or two nights with the Bushes and the neighbors. And, you know, we'd have a couple sessions. They had a big room at Walker's Point, which is the family house, you know, overlooking the water there. It was a big old New England style house. And of course, it's been added to many, many, many times since then. And Debbie has a place there. And I'm sure, you know, everybody in the family has some place in the compound these days. Barbara kind of manned the kitchen. She would prepare these big meals, massive meals of just great stuff, you know, soups at lunch. I wandered into the kitchen one day, and, you know, I love to cook and am a good cook. And I remember her saying, "Rob, if you're not going to work, get your butt out of the kitchen." So, you know, she also was very down to earth, just a wonderful person. And we all would stay. I stayed at Blueberry Hill, which was Jane Russell's. I think it was Jane Russell's home there on, you know, in Kennebunkport. And others would stay around. And then we'd convene for these meetings and have a set of topics. And Bush would lead it. And, you know, my job is sort of to prod people periodically. I remember getting the evil eye one time. We had someone advising on energy, who made the point, which was incorrect, that you know, we talked about the strategic petroleum reserve, which I had mentioned earlier. The idea was that you would store oil, government would store oil that they could use in an emergency, and one of the decisions. This guy said, "Well, you know, that's so screwed up. You know, the pumps can only put it in; they don't have a way to take it out." Which sounds like one of those typical government bureaucratic things.
Sounds so stupid. Yeah,
but in fact, it was wrong. They had designed it in a sort of typical government way to be a pump that, if you had to take it out, you flipped it over and pumped it out rather than, you know. So
right.
So cost saving. Measure, but I just remember saying that, and boy, did I get the evil eye. You know, you're not yet, I think I was probably 29 then, and you're not supposed to contradict the great gurus.
Yeah, right. Especially when you're trying to get their favor, I imagine.
That's
yeah.
Right, when you're trying to get their favor. Yeah, that was the job.
I think most of us have no idea how like a meeting like that would go, how that is conducted. At such a high level, you know, is the meeting a schmooze meeting where he's trying to get them to endorse him, or is this like a legitimate fact finding mission where you're taking the notes and then putting it into a policy paper? Like, what was the goal of the meeting, and then how did it kind of operate, those sorts of preliminary meetings?
Well, I at a high level, you know, I think Bush was very, very interested in policy per se, although he was kind of a practical guy, and he kind of got impatient, you know, if you got into the weeds too much. But he, unless it was on foreign policy, which of course he loved. And so at the high level, what you really want people to do is tell you, and these are all experts and knowledgeable, you want them to tell you what they think are the are the problems in a given area facing the country. You know, you want someone to say, I think that you know, a Paul Volcker, for example, you want him to say that inflation is the worst thing going on right now, and unless we do X, Y, and Z, we can't contain it. And somebody else will say, well, I think we need a tax cut. And someone else will say, we can't afford a tax cut because the budget, the deficit is so big. And of course, the deficit then was nothing compared to what it is now, and including as part of the GDP. And so, you know, you really want people to flush out what they think the big issues are and some approaches. And then after these meetings are over, you know, you have one big kind of meeting, and then you have probably another one later after lunch, and talk about issues that were specifically raised that he would have a very specific interest in. So he might say, you know, politically, I need to do a tax cut, but what I'm hearing from you guys is it's not a good idea, you know, because it expands the deficit. And that's where you also get the divergence between the strains of, you know, within the party and the economy and economic profession and everything else. So, and then the staff, and I was the staff on those, had to go away. And I worked with McAvoy and Gergen and a couple others. And we would, and I, my job was to go out and gather all the facts and write the papers and talk to these guys offline later. And of course, it was all, really was all telephone conversation, because we did not have internet and email and all those kinds of things. I kept meticulous logs of the conversations. You know, some days I talked to 50 people or more. Wow. To try to get something answered. And then some of this would feed into speeches, and a lot of the speechifying was built around, you know, building the image of a knowledgeable candidate. So, you know, we had a speech up, I still remember, up at the Economic Club in Detroit. And I remember driving into that in really a blinding snowstorm. I had no idea that the snowstorm was going to happen, so I was totally unprepared. Sort of, you know, it's hard to imagine you get on a plane without knowing, but that's exactly what happened. And then, so he would do his economic platform there, and we had to basically come up with a tax cut. You know, it was decided we had to have a tax cut. And actually, that was interesting.
Did he look at you and say, read my lips, I want a tax cut?
Yeah, it was sort of like that. Well, actually, what he said was, we can't afford a tax cut unless you can show me how to do it and not raise the deficit. And so I kind of had to sit down with Paul McAvoy and some of these other guys and say, okay, we got to have a tax cut. It's got to cut individual rates, got to do something for business. But we also need to have a feedback loop. You know, that if we cut taxes X, it's not just straight off the top. It actually creates an increase in income for the country as well. So, and economic activity. So that, you know, there's always a little push and pull in these kinds of things. And, he absolutely would not do it unless we could prove to him that it would have a net economic benefit as well as political benefit.
Which really is, when you look at what cost him that 92 election, it was the read my lips thing, you know, no new taxes. But then, you know, he's presented by the Democrats this option of, you know, what was it, for every, you know, one cut we get two spent, or what was the formula, but it eventually led
something like, yeah, that's right.
You know,
yeah, I think that was the one-to-one at that point. That may have been at that point.
But it really led to, you know, we talk about the surpluses that Clinton had, but it was really Bush that helped achieve that, but it cost him his political career.
Well, that it did. And, you know, Reagan also had tax increases as well that people don't recall. I would say on the Clinton, what ultimately led to the surpluses, the very large surpluses, was that, on the one hand, Republicans, he wanted to increase spending, and Republicans wanted to have a tax cut and decrease spending. So ultimately, you have this convergence of he couldn't get the one and they couldn't get the other. Mm-hmm. So he was forced to have, they both had an increase in taxes and a cut in spending, you know, that the Republicans wanted on the other side. So
So that story, you know, I didn't know that story. It's all really fascinating because I knew what you did, but I didn't know how you did it.
Yeah.
And so it leads me to two questions that are kind of related to our modern times. So the first is, you know, when you look at the 2016 campaign, obviously you see that type of preparation in, you know, in Hillary Clinton's campaign. But when you look at Gary Johnson or Donald Trump, like I imagine having that experience working for George H.W. Bush, knowing the man that he was and then also how he operated and how seriously he took all this, you know, you have to be watching some of this Russia stuff with Stone and Papadopoulos and like his core of advisors going, wow. And then, you know, on the flip side, libertarians, this is my main criticism of Gary Johnson in 2016, is that where's the strategy? Where's the policies? Where's the preparation that goes into this? Because, you know, I've read historical books, you know, like Donald Regan's book and some of these other books that kind of talk about these planning meetings when you're going into campaigns, and you just didn't see that. I mean, you had to be sitting there pulling your hair out in 2016 going, is anybody going to prepare to be president who's on the right?
Well, remember that that I was supporting Jeb Bush at the time, and I've known Jeb, and you asked, was W around at the time. Both were there at Kenny Bunkport at one time or another. I mean, I remember meeting W for the very first time. He was kind of stretched out on a blanket on the lawn at Walker's Point with Laura, who I think they were just recently married. And I had met Jeb, I think, in Houston earlier. So I was supporting Jeb in the 2016 election. And he from the get-go, formed issue groups. He had a very talented issue director who had the kind of job I had, you know, however many million years before. And so, you know, I was involved with transportation and a couple other groups. And he was very serious, every bit as serious as his father had been. And Debbie had that too. I was involved with those. But you know, these things do get, they also, it is always a tension between politics and policy and campaigns. So, and you're right, I don't think there was any thinking at all in the Trump campaign. Yeah, I think he was an accidental president in so many ways, and he probably didn't expect to be president. But you know, for example, the Jones Act as an example. So when, which we've talked about, which is the law that requires you to use U.S. built, bought, man-owned, operated ships.
Well, if people want to know more about it, they can go watch your presentation.
Like earlier.
You texted me.
Right.
I tweeted it out. But if you go look up the Jones Act on the Cato Institute, you can watch a video of Rob laying the smackdown on the Jones Act.
And they're publishing a book now too.
Oh, but, cool.
Yeah, but so, you know, I remember in the Ford, I think it was the Bush campaign, Jim Baker one day said, Rob, what is the Jones Act? What position should we take? You know, it's that kind of stuff. And the labor unions, the maritime labor unions, only one union would endorse Republicans. I think it was the Masters, Mates, and Pilots. So it's the, you know, the officers basically. I went back and researched it, and it was this law, and I, you know, it sort of sounded like, you know, who knew? And I have no idea what I recommended. I do know that when W was running, I remember being at a fundraiser with him and with Karl Rove, who was working for him. And W said, well, so what are you doing? And his father had nicknamed me Quartz for my last name. So what are you doing, Quartz? And I said, well, I'm working with this Jones Act Reform Coalition to try to get rid of the Jones Act. And he turns to Carl and says, what's that? And Carl says, American Bottoms. And he says, oh, I hate that law, because he was an oil guy. And the working group on transportation and energy recommended opposing the Jones Act to W. And that kind of, and you know, the former governor of Michigan was the head of that group at the time. And so I had a lot of clout. It was a good group. And sure enough, that was going to be the position. And, you know, it was Haley Barbour, I think, who intervened, saying you can't take that position. You know, you'll lose whatever the hell, Louisiana. I don't know. But anyway, so it was kind of funny and no surprise. And, you know, it's one of these things that Trump should be opposed to, but because it sounds like it's American jobs.
Well, yeah, but that, yeah, right. And so if you want to know more about the Jones Act, you can just search Swamp in the RSS feed and you'll see our past episodes. But
that's an example of the way politics, you know, and that's policy collide.
Yeah. And that's another point is, do you see the libertarian or even Trump conservative? I don't know what they are. Do you see the critique that there's some groupthink in that? When you have a George H.W. Bush putting together, you know, he's giving you the list of people that you ought to call, and it's the guy who worked for Kissinger. So, of course, you're always going to kind of have these same strains of policy because you're talking to the establishment. And, it, you know, how much room was there for dissenting opinions on the prevailing doctrines of the day? Because, you know, somebody like H.W., the criticism is like, well, he is. He's a public servant, but he's also serving the public that has maintained its own power. So counter opinion
getting to
in.
Sort of the disruption argument,
right? That, how does it sneak in?
Trump supporters make for him,
right?
Which is this is a system that's ripe for disruption, and I don't disagree with that. You know, I'm in spent a lot of time with startups and technology and all that, so I personally like disruption, and I would say that if anybody ever did any research on my own political history, I took kind of a mixture of a disruptive posture in a lot of things. And I think by the same token, politics is a conservative business, and people who are expert, you know, this, you know, that you're trying to both optimize for risk and reward. And so you don't get any payback for losing, you know, in foreign policy or the economy or anything else. And you know, honestly, I just think a lot of politicians stay in office because they don't take a risk. Honestly, your reward is you get reelected by not taking a risk. And I think about my own congressional opponent, you know, many, many years ago, who was just lost the election in Florida the former governor, and he'd been in politics for 40 some years. I mean, he'd been in 6 or 7 years by the time I ran against him. So, and I can't think of anything he did ever risky.
Part of the problem is Bill Nelson was no risk taker whatsoever. You could probably elaborate on this more. And that was the rap, that he'd been there for a long time, but he'd never stuck his neck out. And so what did you really have to show? And so you've got somebody like Rick Scott who can pump in a lot of money and make that point. And there is a weird thing in elections where it's like, I'm going to get things done. And then the incentive once you get in office is not to get anything done.
Well, that's right. That's right. Well, and Bill is not a lot different than most politicians, to be honest. You know, you just don't. Risk is not how you get reelected.
Yeah.
If you're willing to take it on, sometimes there's a big payback. So Bush, you know, it's a good question. Would he or did he ever step outside? You know, I probably can't name any times that he took a really risky position on a lot of these things. But on the other hand, it required a lot of gumption to actually prosecute a war in the Gulf. Remember when that was probably not an easy decision to send American troops, no matter how well equipped or no matter how likely the outcome, to the Gulf and do a war. But he did it. And I would say that in his case there, all of his experience kind of came to bear. And he went after Allied support. He he understood the military. He was able to understand the intelligence he was getting, and he could calculate on a rational basis what the actual risk would be.
Well, let me clear
experience and all that comes together.
Yeah, so let me not. I won't debate on that, but I want to clarify my question in that. When you're having these meetings, it's not a matter of making a risk, but was there that type of meeting that you're describing is the information coming in? You know, like or are you only getting an Overton window of establishment to establishment light and never anything that may be outside the bounds, the norms of modern Washington politics in those days?
Well, I think that probably as much as you could get. You know, I think Bush probably had better better sources of information and data than an awful lot of presidential candidates. Remember, he really had been there a long time.
Right.
He had been in the Congress. He'd been in the CIA. He'd been in the political establishment. He had been in China. So each one of these, you know, if he needed to know something, he would call me and say, call so-and-so. And he could get that kind of advice. And I don't think every candidate has that opportunity that he had.
So is the premise of my question flawed in that the type of decisions that he was making, it was hard facts, it was data that it's just like, here are the numbers of, you know, 15 million gallons over here. And like, if that makes sense, like it's...
Yes and no. I think your question, the premise is a good one in the sense that are you just getting the kind of information you want to hear from people who think just like you do?
Right.
You know, and that's an issue not just in politics, but in business, by the way.
Right. And life.
and business guys are by and large risk averse as well. So I think the question is, are you self-aware? Do you understand that there might be something else out there? And sometimes I think experience can make you aware. It can also lead you down a trap. You know, I've seen this 19 times before. It's obviously the same. And in fact, it's not the same. It's a very different situation. So, you know, he was a guy who wanted to get information. So he's not somebody who, you know, who leapt at whatever his gut happened to do that day.
So, okay. So let's fast forward to the funeral. So you actually went to the funeral. You said you were in what row? I actually watched the funeral knowing that you were probably going. So I was like looking in the back trying to see if I could see you. I never found you, but I will probably go back now and see if I can. But so you actually, how do you get invited to a presidential funeral?
You know, they start planning the funeral the day you take office as president.
Okay.
He had planned, his was planned in meticulous detail. A very good friend of mine who I'd worked with literally from the Ford White House on, actually, I think I knew her when she was in the Nixon White House, is a woman named Bobby Kilberg, who is a political powerhouse and very big in the technology community in Northern Virginia. She would be considered a moderate. There are people on the right who consider her a leftist Republican. I would consider her a moderate right of center, but she runs the Northern Virginia Technology Council. She really built that organization. She worked for Bush. She was an advisor during the campaign. She worked for the vice when he became vice president. She did outreach for him. She's a very sophisticated attorney and all that. And Bobby was in charge of the funeral. Now, she was close to the family. She was in Kennebunk all the time. And they just had it planned down to the infinite detail, including who would be invited. And, you know, it was very interesting. There were, you tend to think of people as all being the same, but in fact, there were waves and eras of Bush people. So I had worked as a volunteer for his Senate race when I was a student. And there were people in that office then, a woman named Shirley Green and some others, for example, who were there in the campaign in 1979 that he eventually dropped out in the fall and went to work with Reagan and became the vice president. Then there was a vice presidential staff, which was very different than, for the most part, than the campaign staff. And then there was the presidential staff, and there was carryover, but that was somewhat different. And then and there were people he knew from the CIA and people from China, and people from all of his previous walks of life. And you're on lists, you know, and the question is, can they find you? And so, you know, I got an invitation via email within hours of his death. And then I had an invitation to go out to see the plane, to see the arrival of the plane and the body, and out at Andrews. So that was, you know, we had to leave on, I think that was Monday. We had to leave. I had to leave the house like at 6 a.m. to get up to a local hotel here, where Omni Shoreham, I think, where they had buses for those of us who were invited to do that. And the buses, we waited around a couple hours, and then the buses drove all the way out to Andrews Air Force Base, which was probably a 45-minute drive, and go through all the checkpoints. And then there were three buses. And then we get to the receiving site, and you were standing at the airport, you know, this military airport, for another hour and a half in cold weather. And then a bus arrived from the CIA with a bunch of people who had worked with them, and then one other bus from some other operation. And, you know, the plane arrived finally and came up, and it was very, very impressive. You know, the plane kind of did a flyover and a loop and then landed right in front of all of us. And they had the military band and welcome committee, you know, the family got off, W came, got off, and Jeb and Marvin and Doro and all the rest, and Neil and all the family. And then everybody kind of gathered in another group. And then eventually the rear of the plane opened and they brought out the casket and the music played. I have video of that. It was both somber and impressive. And then, you know, everybody loaded in cars. This probably took an hour or so. And then as they started loading in the cars, W came by, and Laura and the family walked up to those of us who were there who'd been part of the staff. And he just said, "Thank you very much for coming out." And he was very, I think he was very emotional at that point. And then they all took off, and you know, frankly, the crowd was emotional. And then we eventually hopped in the buses and drove back, and it took all day long to do this. And then there were other events around that. And then Tuesday, one of his guys who'd worked for him, a guy named Tom Collimore, who's I think VP at the Chamber of Commerce, threw a reception for all of the people who were there from out of town for Bush. And it was quite an event at the Chambers, probably the best bar scene I've been to in a long time. You know, one of the interesting things in DC is you got all these receptions, and they have sort of fundamental, they have like Jack, you know, Jim Beam, and they have a basic bourbon and sometimes rye, and they have a red and a white wine, and
they have drink sponsors.
Yeah. And they have beer, but they don't have vermouth to make a Manhattan, typically, or they don't have bitters, or they, you know, and I like brown cocktails, and so that had the best bar I've been to in Washington in a long time, and it might be because it was an older crowd. And that was really wonderful. They had passed out little electric candles, and I have mine for everybody at you know, at stroke of a certain hour to turn the candle on. All around the country, people were doing this, and they were throwing. So that was really nice for a moment of silence. But that was like old home week. I will say, there was so many people I had not seen in so long, and everybody felt the same. And you know, it was both kind of, you know, it was the sadness was kind of, you know, way off in the background, and people were really glad to see each other, and they sure exchanged war stories and whatever happened to so-and-so, blah, blah, blah. And then the next day was a funeral and kind of a repeat of getting up early and getting to, you know, the bus and hurry up and wait. And then it was a much bigger group of us. And we there were sections in the cathedral, the National Cathedral, which is, if you've never been to it or ever been to it, is magnificent. And
I have been. It's truly amazing. It's stunning.
Yeah. And it took, you know, I think 75 or 80 years to finally finish. But it was divided into sections, and we were, those of us from the early days were pretty close up to the front there, you know, on the main aisle. I was about 8 rows back from the front. I could see when Obama and Jimmy and Rosalind Carter and all walked in, and Trump and everybody greeting each other. And you know, every time I turn around, I'd see somebody I hadn't seen in 10 or 20 or 30 or sometimes 40 years from the early days. I really chuckled, several of us did, to the left under the eaves. You know, there are two big main sections down the main floor of the cathedral, and then you have the columns, and then kind of under the sides, there's a bunch of other places. And they had put the whole Congress over under one of the eaves.
I noticed that. And so that's one of the questions, not to be indelicate, but, you know, I read Our Town by the New York Times writer, and it opens with Tim Russert's funeral and talks about, how, you know, the state funeral and kind of. And I wonder if something like that, are you like, you're in row 8, and then you just know someone in row 10's like, I can't believe he's in row, like, is it?
Oh, I'm sure.
Is it? And so I saw, like, my congressman sitting under the, like, way in the back. I was like, I got to get a better congressman.
Well, actually, we saw a friendly, Barbara Comstock, who I'm friends with, and had just lost her race. You know, in the sweep, and Barbara was walking by, and we, several of us, invited her to sit with us, which she did. but the sections were, you know, it was sectioned off. I mean, I was in the outside of the row. There were about 8 seats, I think, 8 or 9, and I had invited, you know, I was allowed to bring one person, and my wife was at a board meeting out of town, otherwise she'd have gone. And I had an email from another young guy. At the time, it was a guy named John Osborne, who was a great friend, but he was a student when he went to work for me in the campaign in 1979, I think. And he had just sent me an email saying, how do I get a seat? You know, this, you know, you asked.
And man, I should have been,
well,
I should have been quicker.
As it turns out, I have a seat. and John, you know, met me and of course sat with me there. And it was really nice. I mean, you know, he said, and I had another person say to me the same, similar something. He said, you know, I just have to thank you for bringing me into the campaign and letting me work. And that led to all sorts of things in my career. And I, you know, I turned around and there's another woman, Connie Horner, who had a very successful career. She had written some for the New York Times, Sunday Magazine, some interesting articles, and she came as a volunteer, and as she told me, she said, Rob, I have to thank you for doing all this stuff. You accepted me, you know, and she says, I began, you know, the campaign made me, sent me to you and as a typist and answering the phones. And she said, you said to me after 2 or 3 days, I think there's some better things for you to do. And, you know, Connie did really well. She became head of the Office of Personnel Management and senior person at HHS and this and that. And now is a major corporate board. It's just a fabulous, fabulously accomplished
person. I think
that's
such a great point, too, that, you know, my own career has really been helped and made by starting out in college volunteering for campaigns. You know,
yeah.
I owe everything in my career to starting out in campaigns. And it's like, if you want to end up in the elite, then that's where you start shoveling, you know, envelopes and stuffing
right.
envelopes. And then, you know, 25 years later, you look back at that moment when you decided to volunteer for Bros McVeigh or Scott Keller. you know, people who are forgotten in your local politics, but then you owe your connections. And it's right. It's not the volunteering that matters. It's the connections of, you know, being involved with these people. And it really, well, it's if you you're know, a young person. Is,
yeah. In politics, you have to trust people.
Yeah.
You have to know who you can trust. And I think the art of volunteering, you know, the act of volunteering is an act of trust to the politician on the other side of it. So, although, as you know, these days, there are people who are stuck in campaigns to be the spy. And I'm sure there was some of that then. But anyway, so it was, again, it was just one of these very interesting, it was partly a social event too. And kind of across the aisle from my row of seats, Henry Kissinger was over there and, you know, right up front, Jim Baker and the whole family. And, you know, it was really, you know, you obviously period, you catch somebody's eye, you knew in the family or this or that. It was sort of sad being set up. And then, you know, some of the great remarks, Meacham gave a great eulogy.
The Canadian,
Mulroney was really wonderful. And all a lot of war stories and all that. And I would say the saddest moment probably was, I thought the preacher from Houston, who had been his preacher down there, gave a terrific homily. And so all that was, it was a really very moving and inspiring. But for the most part, people were kind of happy. And there was a group of young people in the row in front of me, young men and women all in their 20s. And I would say they were as emotional as anybody I had seen. It turns out they were part of his Houston staff.
Hmm.
So, you know, they had been with him and very close to him there. And then, you know, Jim Baker, who's a fabulous person, he was just distraught. You know, yeah. He was probably more so than anybody you could see. And then, but I would say the moment that was probably the saddest for people, where it all came home, was when they took the casket out. You know, that's where you really kind of know this is it, you know.
Yeah.
So, but it was a great moment and a real celebration. And you know, of course, he represents, as you sort of alluded, a kind of politician and a person who you don't see a lot of these days.
I felt this way about the McCain funeral, where McCain's funeral, I mean, the juxtaposition between the two just shows you the difference in the character of the men, where mm-hmm. McCain's funeral is just kind of gross because he made it all about the times that people will not remember in 30 years, where, you know, Bush's funeral was really about, you could tell the family said no Trump bashing, right. You know, and it was all about H.W. the man. But you really get a sense with these two funerals that it was almost a funeral for a type of politics that will never return. And, yeah. You know, with McCain's funeral, it's like they're, you know, you have, you know, Biden giving the speech and it's like the frenemies, you know, that era left. And then with HW, you know, the statesman, the kind of the last of the statesmen, and we're left with kind of this hollow politics that's just.
Well, it's sort of generationally the last two, because remember he was the last guy who really had served in a war, and he was the last guy from World War II. And we don't have any of those anymore. So, but anyway, it was really something. It was quite an event.
Well, we talked ourselves right into an hour. So we'll have to talk a little bit about, I mean, do you have any thoughts? I mean, we got a couple minutes here. I am curious, before we go, your thoughts on the shutdown and you know, obviously Trump caved and Pelosi looked like she outmaneuvered him. So what was your take on that?
Yeah, that's I think that's a really good question. And of course, the shutdown was, first of all, we all know it's the longest in history. It probably cost about $11 billion in a multi-trillion dollar budget. That's not a lot of money, but it had an impact, and it certainly cost more than the $5.6 billion. I think you're also correct that Trump caved. I will say the person who did the most for themselves in this is probably Nancy Pelosi. You know, she went in Trump immediately, if you remember the White House meeting, accused her of, or tried to diss her by saying she really wasn't secure in her power yet. She hadn't won the speakership, and she chided him by saying, don't characterize my strength, Mr. President. And it should have been a little bit of a warning to him. I think there are a couple things that came out of it. One is there was a strengthening of the Congress as a separate and equal branch of government. And I think if you're a Republican or a Libertarian, you think the Congress is an equal branch of government is a good thing. And so I think she settled that a bit. I think the other thing, and I would say she had a lot of spine. I thought her maneuver on the State of the Union was brilliant. I thought it was game changing. And, you know, this is where you talk risk.
In what way was it game changing?
Well, I think, first of all, I hadn't even thought about it myself. And, you know, I was watching, I was trying to figure out where it was going to land. And the fact that she said, okay, you can't come, you know, you've changed the landscape. I'm going to change it too. So it really did change the dynamic. You know, he thought he could bull his way around it. Remember, he said, well, I'm going to come anyway. And of course, it turns out you can't. You have to be formally invited. And
McConnell was not going to get caught giving him. He wanted no part of it.
No. The other thing that I think came out of it is, you know, people by and large don't give a crap about federal workers and their pain. You know, they basically think they're lazy and shiftless and everything else, even if they know someone. If they know a guy, well, you know, he's a federal worker. And I think at the beginning of the shutdown, that was the attitude. But as things started to break down, and they did start to break down, you know, FAA, the airports and flying, that all began to break down with the TSA and the inspections. The Food and Drug Administration had stopped doing inspections.
The SEC had stopped.
Business guys who bitch and moan about regulation, they still know they got to go through it. So they couldn't get anything done. They might not like it, but it's the process. The people getting permits out of EPA, who actually been getting them more easily, all of a sudden couldn't get any. So I think people by the end of it were starting to realize that these people actually do a job that is embedded in our society. The other thing, of course, is they talked a lot about the 800,000, but here in Northern Virginia, there are millions of people whose jobs are primarily and secondarily dependent on these guys and women coming home and doing their job. And, one thing everybody thinks is a federal worker is overpaid. Well, there are an awful lot of federal workers who make $22,000 a year and on average under 40 or thereabouts. And, you know, that's not a lot of money to live in those kind of circumstances. So we know that probably over half, if not 55 or 60% of all Americans live paycheck to paycheck. So you could start to feel the impact in grocery stores and like the Smithsonian shuts down. Well, those cafeterias are run by private companies and the people who run them are private employees and they all lost their jobs and they're not going to make that money up. Federal employees will, if they were required to work without pay, they'll get their money back. You know, so some $8 billion, I think they calculated, of the $11 billion costs will come back to the economy, but some of it's lost.
The ironic thing is that they shut it down over a $5.7 billion wall, and $5.7 billion was lost.
Yeah, but it's never about. But you know, and we all know it was not about the money. Trump could not. Trump has to get a wall for his supporters. You know, and. Pelosi cannot let him have a wall for his supporters. So, I think they'll probably do some face-saving thing in the end, which is some commission to determine if and where a wall or barrier or steel or whatever the hell you want to call it is going to be put. That will be the only way out because it's not about money. It's not about necessity. The conversation is not about what people need. It's about he promised to Wall he can't have it. He promised to Wall he has to have it. And so that's the gist.
You know, I'm obviously a libertarian, and I look at it and I go, 800,000 unnecessary jobs, like maybe there's some trimming, and that's probably all true. And, you know, there's always the jokes and the memes that go around about, you know, the shutdown and all that. And I think some of that's funny. And I do kind of, it does resonate with me that, you know, you see week one, like people having to pawn heirlooms, and you just go, you work for a company basically that has shut down how many times since 1980? Like you don't save for a rainy day. So there is I don't have a lot of sympathy, but I do think that it is not necessarily the appropriate, nor is it the empathetic point of view from a libertarian to sit there and go, you know, good. I'm glad these people are suffering, because it seems like a very cruel way to run a government, because we're all kind of held hostage. These people are held hostage at the egos of two people. That's why I want to decrease the power of government, because like here we are having all these ill effects, and you look at the Joshua trees and the Easter seals on the beaches and all this stuff, and you just go, you know, we're all held hostage by these two lunatics fighting over power. And what if we just take that away from them, and then we don't have these problems anymore?
Yes, but that, so now we have a couple senators trying to pass bills that I don't think will pass. I don't think they'll pass constitutional muster that would outlaw shutdowns by authorizing that the budgets would just continue at the same level, basically permanent continuing resolutions. I don't think that's going to pass in the end, but you know, you do have to have some empathy for these people. And it's not just 800,000 people. It's another couple million people. They're contractors who work for the government. And some of them, you know, I have a company that has government contracts, and fortunately, ours were funded already, and in other parts of the government, we got by. But think about the fact that the bulk of the people who were laid off were associated with security, national homeland security. They were TSA. They were the customs agents, the Secret Service protecting the president and his family were not getting paid. So that's the other irony of this. That it was over that agency in particular. And then State Department functions didn't get done. Of course, the State Department's not functioning anyway, as far as we can tell, since half of the ambassadors aren't appointed, so we have no one to talk to. So anyway.
Yeah, I mean, it's just hard for people to find sympathy, because when the IRS shut down my dad's business for 2 months over $75, you know, they didn't care if he wasn't getting paid. And so it's just not. And I think a lot of people, just the way that the nature of bureaucracy itself, if you read Ludwig von Mises' Bureaucracy, you kind of see how all this operates. And you just go, you know, I have.
But I'll bet
I think
your
every
dad got upset when he didn't get his tax refund because there's no one to process it.
Well, that's a whole different story with my dad and taxes. But you know, it's just. But I also kind of go, well, you should extend the empathy that you wanted them to have for you towards them,
right?
You know,
that's
and so
right.
That's right. Really where the rubber meets the road in trying to make the world a better place is the people that you owe nothing to. How are you going to treat them?
That's right.
I do totally understand the lack of empathy and also the outrage of people who are working and not getting paid. It's like, I wouldn't go to work if I weren't getting my paycheck.
Yeah.
So I don't blame LaGuardia.
Yeah, no, it's so I think a couple things came out. But I'd say it was a major miscalculation on his part, on Trump's part. And in this big game, you know, Pelosi did win that one. And I will say, you know, what I actually am more worried about in the long run is whether or not this discredits his approach. More so than it is already discredited with the Chinese and the Iranians and, you know, everyone else he's negotiating with and taking this kind of hard line, you know, I'll never budge kind of stance. So, that, you know, that's what I worry about.
There hasn't been a time where he hasn't folded. There just isn't. The great deal maker has folded every single time. And so when you hear North Korea saying this week, yeah, but we're still making nukes, you go, yeah, no kidding. Like,
yeah, right. Yeah, wait, well, but he doesn't believe it just because his intelligence chief said that.
He's insane, yeah.
Anyway.
You just look at this and you go, I know the Democrats are going to screw this up somehow because that's what they do. But we'll have to talk 2020 and some of that other stuff later. But, yeah. but let's end on your guide to dining in DC. You love going out to eat. And so what is your recommendation if you visit the nation's capital? Where should you go?
Well, so I love good Mexican food, but you know, there are two levels of Mexican food. There is the taco level, and there can be good and bad ones. And there's some great, great, great street food level Mexican and Tex-Mex in Washington. But fine Mexican dining is also a terrific experience. And there is a restaurant that opened 6 or 8 months ago in Washington over near the center city called Poca Madre with this very, very good chef, Victor Albizu. And I would say that if you're interested in something very different, we had a terrific duck for the table that you sort of shred and had great makings of with soft tortillas and several other interesting dishes that went with it, and really, really terrific mezcal drinks. I love mezcal.
What is mezcal?
Mezcal and rye.
Explain that to me. I'm unfamiliar.
Well, you know tequila.
I've heard of it.
Yeah, right. So mezcal is kind of a lower. I think it's made on it with a different plant.
Okay,
but it's still in the same kind of family of the big cactus plants.
Gotcha.
And it's a little, typically a little raw and a little smokier. Mm. And what I like about it is the smoky. And you can substitute it in some drinks for the tequila. And I've had mezcal Manhattans and all that. But I'll tell you, the food is great. Service is great. It's not a huge restaurant. It's a beautiful restaurant. So I recommend to you Poca Madre.
All right. Very good. Well, final thoughts? Anything that people should be paying attention to between now and our next visit?
It's been fascinating. And you and I can talk about it next time we get together about 2020. I think what's fascinating is watching people start to tout Larry Hogan, and he's on the Republican side, not just Kasich. And on the Democrat side, of course, you're starting to see a bunch of candidates. And I must say, I saw this young mayor, Buttigieg, as you told me his name is pronounced, who was the mayor of South Bend. I thought he was, he's a Rhodes Scholar, a little canned, but boy, He not only had a good rationale for his running, but he actually could talk about what we should do in Afghanistan, which, let me just say, the clay feet for most presidential candidates are that they don't know anything about foreign policy. So, and then I have another good friend who's in politics who thinks Kamala Harris is going to be the winner. And,
I don't. So, I think her positions are wholly scary, and I think
I think there are a lot of scary positions out there.
So and I think
we can talk about this.
Yeah, we should not get into it because we have lots of thoughts, but we'll shoot for next week. So all right, great. Well, it was great talking to you.
2 weeks.
And we'll reconvene. And maybe by that time we'll be in a different feed. So yeah, if you enjoy these conversations, I'll let you listeners know when you can go jump into that feed and,
send us any questions.
Yeah, and please send questions, editor@wearelibertarians.com. And we love, Rob loves to take your questions. You can be like the press or whomever called on that phone when he worked for Gerald Ford and ask him questions. And then he can go get the answers and tell you what's up. So, all right. Thanks, Rob. It was great talking to you.
Thanks.
All right.